You're listening to Episode 3 of Season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order. In this episode, we're going to talk about, well, some of the stuff that I promised we were going to talk about last week and then lied, but like Torchlight and Humble Indie Bundle. We'll talk about spell checking in KRunner, it's incredible. We'll talk about compressors, audio compressors, and Lightworks, and a grep trick that I learned, and all kinds of cool stuff, so let's just get started. Let's start out with listener feedback. I don't have that much this time because I'm actually recording this episode a fair number of days in advance, so I don't know. I'm liable to get a whole bunch of feedback in, and they won't be in this episode, so, you know, if that's the case, I'm sorry, but I am recording this a little bit early just so that it gets out on time. So, Lightworks. A guy named New Chalk. Could be a girl. Someone named New Chalk asked me about Lightworks, basically said that they didn't know whether they should be excited or not, which I thought was a great way of asking that question. I thought that was really well put, because, and I don't mean that to sound patronizing, but I really do think that that was well stated, because I think that's a lot of how a lot of us feel. It's like, wow, this seems really exciting. Should we be excited? We don't know. Because we've all been lied to before, and not just on Linux. I'm not saying, like, it's a Linux problem. It's a software thing. You know, they didn't invent the term vaporware for nothing, right? That exists. People know that concept, and we're all used to it. And maybe we are a little bit hyper-aware of it in Linux. I don't know that I am, because I think that my entire computing experience has been kind of like that. I've been on platforms that, at least at the time, were not necessarily the most popular, certainly not the ubiquitous platform. So I feel like I'm well acquainted with vaporware. So when I heard about Lightworks coming out, it did seem exciting, it did seem significant, and it also seemed like a great candidate for vaporware. I mentioned Lightworks to a couple of people at the production house where I work, or the people on the production house side of the place that I work, and they were very well familiar, you know, very well acquainted, rather, with Lightworks. Maybe not personally. I mean, it's really, from what I'm gathering, I've never used it, but from what I'm gathering, it's something that is used in studios mostly on the West Coast, and it's used because of the software-hardware integration, or it was. That doesn't mean it's everywhere. There are some other software editors that are everywhere, and Lightworks was not one of them, but it was a high-end product. In the editing world, that means something, and it doesn't mean a whole lot, you know, because, I mean, there are high-end products that aren't necessarily the greatest product. There are ubiquitous projects that aren't necessarily ubiquitous. I mean, that's kind of universal. So there you go. It exists. It has been used. People are familiar with it. But hearing them talk about it, I kind of started getting excited about it, too. I kind of started to feel like this could be a big deal. And then very recently in the video editing world, some big upheavals have happened that, in my opinion, have made some really significant openings for other editing software to come in and steal a little bit of the market, steal a little bit of the spotlight. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone saw this coming, and I don't know that anyone's really poised to steal that market. But that's okay. I still think, overall, Lightworks is an exciting thing. And so after New Chalk told me, or asked me about this, rather, I went to the website of Lightworks, lwks.com, I think it is, off the top of my head, looked it up. Saw on the forum that a guy, one of the developers there, had posted a video of Lightworks launching on Ubuntu. I was pretty excited about that. That catapults it from vaporware to something that works on Ubuntu, which is really exciting. And now I am really excited, because Lightworks is really, really promising. Honestly, I'm not necessarily saying, and again, I've not used it, so I don't know. That's not true. I've used it very, very briefly. I don't know a whole lot about it. So I'm not saying that Lightworks will come in and be ahead above everything else, because I really hold Kdenlive Live in high esteem. It's gotten me through a couple of different editing projects, has done remarkably well, really excited about it in general. So I'm fine with that. But if Lightworks comes along, I think it's going to be a big deal for two different reasons. Number one, because of the choice thing, right? We want to have a couple of different choices out there. I think that's very reasonable. And I don't mean choices like, well, you can have Kdenlive, which is really, really great, or you can have some other editors that may or may not work all the time, and they'll get there eventually. It's not going to be like that. It'll be, you can have Kdenlive, which is great, or you can have Lightworks, which is great. And that's a powerful, powerful thing, wonderful thing. I'm very excited about that. But the second thing is that it's going to be multi-platform. Windows, Linux, and the other one. So, really exciting about having an editor that can be used on all platforms. I don't know if it's because of the world that I'm in right now that I've always liked cross-platform applications. I think most of us do. Most of us, I think, recognize the importance of it. I lately have been really feeling the importance of it, because it's one of those, it's hard enough to sell people on getting away from name brands anyway. You know, that they don't have to use this product because it's got the name and the marketing, that they can use these other products and do as good, if not better, as what they were using before. But if it's not cross-platform, then it's even a bigger hurdle, you know? It's just like, wow, how do I tell them to switch to, not only switch to Kdenlive, but also to switch to Linux? I mean, that's just a big, and it's not even because, I don't even think it's because the interface of the OS is completely different, etc., etc. I mean, it's also because if they were to literally switch to Linux, they would have to start from ground zero on everything, including their graphics editor, including their vector drawing program, including their Office application, and all those other stupid things that you and I have heard all the time. But they're valid, you know. I mean, and if we're being understanding and tolerant of others and all that other good stuff, it's understandable. It's a lot to ask. But, of course, the old trick of saying, hey, here's OpenOffice, or LibreOffice even, here's Firefox, here's Thunderbird, and here's Lightworks, and Blender, and all these applications that are cross-platform, they work exactly the same, no matter what you're running, that's a big deal. It's important, it's significant. Oh, VLC is another one. It's important, it's significant, it draws people into the free brand, as it were, and at some point, ostensibly, feasibly, you could swap out their OS, and suddenly they'd be running everything free. I don't know how important any of that stuff is in the larger scheme of things. I'm in a semi-apathetic mood right now, I guess, and whether or not they switch to Linux, I don't care. Whether or not they use software that is open source, that respects their data, I think that's a big deal, and Lightworks will be that, and that's important. So, and I would be happy and very quick to recommend Kdenlive to people, but the fact is that it's just not multi-platform, not really. Not in the way that you could actually hand it to someone and say, here, install this. So, Lightworks, yes, be excited. It runs on Linux, unless this developer was just trolling everyone and did a fake video, which I kind of doubt. It's right there on the forums, official developer screenshots, or rather video of it running on Linux. It's very exciting. It's a very capable application. It's not a lightweight kind of, let's take a stab at making a video editor. It's a serious thing. And you can still get that controller. $3,000. It's on their site. Got a spam mail from them about it the other day. So, and of course, you'll be able to purchase extra codec support and stuff like that. I honestly think it's a pretty good model, that they're giving the software itself away, and if people want to buy more codecs, they can, which is fair. I mean, I don't know, codecs exist. They are owned by other people. If you don't want to grab FFmpeg and use that to transcode stuff or whatever, then yeah, just pay for the stupid codec. I mean, it's in that sense, I really do. I think that's a fair model, especially for an industry that kind of understands that sort of thing. And then the controller is available, so if they're really wanting to get into high speed editing, like efficient kind of editing, then they've got that available for them. I think it's a neat experiment in a larger sense, and it's very exciting that they're doing the whole Windows, other, and Linux thing as well. So yeah, be excited. That's the verdict. Okay, I think that's about all the listener feedback I got, but this is vaguely related. So I'm going to kind of talk about this as if though it was listener feedback. It's not, but we'll talk about it as if though it was. The website, of course, there's been some discussion both on the Hacker Public Radio feed and coincidentally internally and with a listener of this show about the date format that RSS really does want. Someone emailed me after 800 came out, episode 0 came out, and said that the date, or the podcast came in as a 1970 January 1st podcast, and I think it was in G-Potter, and I thought that was curious, and so I verified what date format RSS considered valid, and according to the Harvard page on RSS, I was doing it right. I didn't think to validate it, because I didn't know there was an RSS validator, but I think it was 5150 or Epicanus, or someone was talking about the HPR feed not validating, and that it required the date to be in RFC 882 or 822 format, something like that. Well, I don't know. I haven't gotten any other complaints about the dates in my feed, so I'm going to assume that that's kind of, like, fixed. And if not, then let me know. I have changed the command in my podcast, in my RSS feed generator, which I don't know if I've really talked about that yet on this show, so I'll mention it really quickly. I think I have, actually. But I wrote this during the little hiatus that I took for the month between season 7 and 8. And it's just a shell script that I run locally. It's not like a shell script or it's not a script that runs on the server as you view the page or anything like that. You know, it's a local script that I run. And it generates the HTML page by appending something from a text file that I feed it to parse. And then from that, also, that same text file, it creates the RSS feeds. So what I did to maybe fix this weird date issue that may or may not even exist is where I put in the pub date, I do the result of the command date space dash dash RFC dash 3339 equals date. And that appears to be giving a more valid date. So I don't know. I'm not really convinced yet that I know what exactly RSS considers valid and all that other good stuff, but that's what we're trying today, so let me know how that works. Other exciting news about the website itself is that Cobra 2, who you'll certainly know from, well, I've interviewed him at Linux Fests before, I think, or he's certainly been in a couple of episodes about Linux Fests. And you may know him also from, like, Hacker Public Radio and things like that. But he's got a mirror up of the GNU World Order site, which is just really, really cool. So if you go to cctracker.org:81, then that's the Mirror of GNU World Order website. So should this site ever disappear, it will also be over there, which is nice. A couple of other things. Someone, actually Crayon in IRC, you might know him from DevRandom, told me that, or reminded me, I guess, or pointed out to me that there were that I hadn't transferred the old XML files for like the previous season. So like if you wanted to download the entire season, the entire seventh season or whatever, or sixth season of this show, you could not do that. So I uploaded the XML files for each season, like aug7.xml, aug6.xml, etc. And those are found in the archive section of the website. So if you go into archive and then choose whatever season you want to go into from there, you will find somewhere in that folder, in addition to all the augs, the XML files. And just no one actually complained about this or said anything about it, but I should mention that there were a couple of episodes here and there missing from the archive. I didn't have them immediately on the backup drive that I had available to me immediately, so I was just kind of biding my time, and then I got the hard drive in the mail, and because it was in storage somewhere, so I got that in the mail, and everything is now uploaded. It's got entire, you know, all of season 4. I think there were like 2 random episodes out of there missing. A couple of episodes from season 2 I think were missing, and I think quite a few from 5 or something like that. Point is, it's pretty much complete at this point. I'm still working on those show notes, which I feel kind of bad about. I might just have to cop out and put the old show notes on the site, but I'd rather make them nice and pretty. But until someone bugs me about it, I'll probably just try to get around to it eventually. And that's about it for website news and listener feedback. A couple of people have been asking me lately, both like online and in real life, what the deal is with audio compressors, and I could have sworn I wrote a really good sort of how-to on that subject in Slacker Media, and then I went back and read it, and it was okay, but it wasn't that great. So, let's talk a little bit about compressors. And this is not, don't fast forward yet, this is not compression, like codecs and compression. This is a dynamic range compression, meaning that if you have a sound wave and it's kind of wobbling and wiggling as sound waves do from, like, I don't know, let's just say negative 15 decibels. It's peaking, you know, the peaks of those little waves are hitting negative 15 decibels. And then you have some louder sounds that are peaking out at a different volume, like at, I don't know, negative 5 decibels, right? Then you have a difference there of a low sound, like when someone's talking softly, of negative 15 decibels, and a loud sound of negative 5 decibels. So you have a difference of about, what, 10 decibels, pretty much, right? If my math is correct. So in some cases, that's fine, and it really depends on what your goal is. You may want there to be a difference of 10 decibels there. You might like that. That is called a dynamic range, because you have soft stuff in one place, and then you have every shade of loudness between there up until about 5 decibels. Maybe sometimes it peaks out at negative 3, but mostly it averages around negative 5. Whatever. Classic example of why that would be a good thing would be in a movie or in a TV show. You are mixing your audio, or in a radio play. You're mixing your audio and you want some traffic to be happening. Well, not traffic. Let's say you want some, let's say this. Let's say you want the dialogue to be at like negative 15 decibels. That's actually not that uncommon. And you want to surprise the audience with like a sound effect, like a gunshot or something. Now that gunshot should pop out. You want that to be a pronounced thing. So now one way to do that would be to make sure that your gunshot happens at negative 5 decibels. That would be loud compared to normal conversation happening at negative 15. You could have people shouting maybe at negative 10, but that gunshot, which is just supposed to pop, make that peak out at -5 decibels, and suddenly people are, you know, starting to fall asleep, and then they hear this gunshot at -5 decibels, they're jumping out of their chair. So that's a classic example of when that would be a good thing. Classic example of when that would be a bad thing is, let's say, an audio interview. You're interviewing someone for a show, and your connection's not good, or whatever, their microphone's not as good as yours, they're talking at -15, your voice comes in and it's like at -5. That's just annoying, and also it sounds weird and kind of unprofessional. So there's a dynamic range there, and if you need to reduce that dynamic range, you could also call it compressing the dynamic range, and that would obviously mean that you would be bringing your -15 decibels up while you are bringing your -5 decibels down, and you're kind of making it, well, less dynamic, right? You're making it a little bit more normal. Okay, so the tool for that job is called a compressor, an audio compressor, or a dynamic range compressor, and you can apply that in any good audio software, really. Audacity has one. QTractor has quite a few. Ardour would have quite a few. LADSPA itself, the infamous, well, not infamous, actually famous, Steve Harris LADSPA plugins have quite a few, and CAF plugins actually has a compressor. So you've got a range of compressors available to you. The question then would be how to use them. And unfortunately, because of what compressors are dealing with, there's not really a way, I don't imagine, for the author of the compressor, or the manufacturer for that matter, if it's a hardware compressor, to make a quote-unquote sane default for you. I mean, there's just no way of telling what your audio is doing. And that's kind of up to you to figure that out. The view in Audacity that you should be using if you are using compressors is to have the waveform expressed in dBs. There are a couple of views in Audacity, and if you click on the name of the track in Audacity, you can actually modify how you're viewing it. You want to see it expressed in decibels, counting down from, I think, the default view that I usually see is from 0 to 36, or I should say 0 to -36. You should look at that and see where your high, your peaks are, and where your sound is at its low point. And beyond that, you should see where the sound is low when it is just noise, meaning that you've just got room tone. You know, no one's speaking, it's just kind of the general atmosphere of the room that you're in. That right there, that signal where, or that sound where people are not talking, but there's still sound, that's generally speaking called the noise floor, because that's the base layer of really undesirable signal. Like, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to deal with noise. We could just say, oh, there's the voices, let's pull them out and put them right here, and they'll sound crisp and clear. That's not how it happens. You have this noise floor. Now, if you were just to amplify your signal, even if you, for instance, if you had one person talking at -15, one person bellowing out at -5, if you were to just amplify just that quiet person at -15 up to -5 to make everything match, the way sound waves work, you don't just get to amplify the voice, obviously. You by default amplify both the noise floor, the noise in the background, and the voice, because that's how sound works. You're amplifying everything. You're strengthening the signal. That's bad. Compressors, in a way, are brilliant because they kind of let you amplify just the voice. The trick is that you only get to do it based on where those sound waves are ending up, so you can choose like a range that you want to affect. So if you know your noise floor, for instance, is at -30 decibels. You know that your quiet speaker is at -15 decibels, and your loud is -5. then you could tell a compressor unit to take anything from negative 15 or negative 16, 14 or so, and raise it. Don't raise anything that is clocking in at like negative 5 decibels or so, or maybe even negative like 7 and above. Don't touch that. And let the compressor do its magic. And what it will do, and it usually does this quite well, and I always imagine it kind of as almost like a, like if you're just kind of reaching down into a bucket of sound waves, you're only reaching as far down as like negative 15 or so, and you're pulling those up more or less to the negative 5 range. So you just kind of, you target those low sound waves at negative 15, but you don't go any lower. Because if you go lower, you're going to snag some noise in your little rake that you're grabbing stuff with. So you wouldn't want that. So it simply uses this sort of threshold right at negative 15. If it's negative 15 or higher, raise it up until you reach the negative 5 and then stop. And don't raise up the negative 5 articles. Go lower than that. I hope that makes sense. It's a little bit hard to explain, to be honest, but I think that kind of makes sense. Noise floor is low. Your low voice is higher than the noise floor, but lower than your high voice, so you're just targeting basically that low voice. And you're telling it to ignore anything above a certain level. So the effect, then, is that you're not only raising the negative 15 decibel voice up toward that negative 5 decibel voice. Might not be, it's not going to be exact, you know, but it'll get that average up closer to negative 5 decibels. But if you've noticed, you've left your noise floor exactly where it is. And that's a big deal, because the relation, the ratio of that good signal, in this case voices, to the noise floor has just increased. So now the noise is much, much less noticeable, because our human ears are going to be focusing our attention on the thing that we recognize, which would be the human voice speaking a language that we understand. We're going to kind of lose track of that noise floor because it kind of got left way down there at negative 30 decibels or wherever I said it was. And plus, I mean, if those voices are nice and strong, then you figure the end user, the listener, the audience, whatever you want to call them, they're not going to turn up their volume too much. You know, they're going to be like, oh, I can hear those voices fine. So the noise floor literally just kind of gets left behind, hanging out there down at negative 30 decibels, and it just never gets noticed. I mean, if you turn it way up, yeah, you'll notice it. And that's true of anything. I mean, if you go back to old classic analog synth albums, or if you go back to a record that was recorded a long time ago where they didn't have completely noise-proof booths and things like that, you'll hear the noise. You know, you will hear stuff back in the background that at normal listening volume you frequently do not hear because it's mixed better than that. You know, the instruments or the voices were closer to the mic, so they just overpowered the noise. But the noise is there. That's natural. And that's what dynamic range compressor does. So that's a huge benefit. So let me kind of take you through more or less like the Steve Harris plugin. It's a little bit actually more complex than some of the other ones, but we'll go with it because it's kind of one of the more powerful ones. So the first selection when you open up a compressor, or the Steve Harris compressor anyway, is the threshold. And that's telling the compressor where to sort of lower the bar above which everything will be raised. So in my example here, it would be negative 15, maybe negative 16 or 17 decibels, i.e. something louder than the noise floor, but something that will still, as it gets, as it sort of raises up, will still snag those audio waves and bring them up along with it, if you imagine that. So it would be like, if we're noticing a lot of voices hanging out around negative 15 decibels pretty consistently, then that's where we would set our threshold to. I like to set it a little bit lower just for safe. The second selection is the noise floor, and that's the part where it just totally ignores, like, under this limit, nothing, the sound waves will not be affected. So that's obviously just as much as the threshold, it's a very individual kind of thing. It just depends on where you're noticing your noise. Sometimes it's loud-ish, and it's at, like, negative 30 decibels. Sometimes it's not. It's, like, way down at negative 40. Whatever makes more sense for you is where you would want to set that noise floor to. You don't want to set it so high that you're accidentally snagging some voice in there. You know, you want your voice or whatever, you know, your signal to be raised. So you don't want to try to use this as just a noise cancellation thing. You want to just suppress the noise and raise the signal. So it's a little bit tricky, but if you look at your audio, you listen to your audio, listen to the noise, figure out where that's pegging on the meter, the VU meter. And if you're seeing your noise really, really low, then set your noise floor really, really low. If it's starting to creep up in there with some very, very quiet voice, you might have a hard time separating those two. And in order to raise the voice, you might be raising some or all of your noise, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of this. But it really depends. You know, if the noise has on an equal level to your signal, yeah, you got problems, and a compressor's not really going to be able to fix it for you. But if there is a gap between that noise floor and that low signal, that's great. Set your noise floor to the noise level, maybe a little bit higher for safety, and then set your threshold just under that sort of average level of your signal. Now, the next one is is the ratio. Now, the ratio is saying how much it's going to, when that threshold bar grabs onto those quieter signals, how far is it going to raise those things up? And if signals are too loud, how far is it going to bring those down? So the ratio is going to be typically fairly small. For the things that I've ever done, I have found that setting a high ratio sounds like you're using a compressor. It's kind of hard to describe, and I don't know that I could mimic it in real time right now, or even in post, actually. I'm not so sure that I could. I could try. I might try. But for it to sound natural, which is generally what your goal is, a 2-to-1 ratio is usually pretty good. If you go higher than that, I have found you start to hear the compressor. You kind of hear like this. I've heard people call it, describe it as a pumping sound, almost like a machine what are those pneumatic sort of pump sound or something. It never really sounded like that to me, but it is something noticeable. Now, if you're using it for music, it actually is kind of a cool effect. I mean, I hear people use that on drums a lot. You know, they want the snares to pop, and so they'll put that compressor on a 4-to-1 ratio. So they're bringing down the snare, and the lead up to that snare is super drastic, and the snare still pops. It doesn't go out into your danger zone, but it really pops away from everything. It's got that room to have that dynamic range. But it's almost accentuating drums away from like room tone and stuff like that. So there's a certain kind of sound to that effect, and that's also related to the attack and the decay time. The attack and decay is sort of how soon the compressor kind of kicks in, and when it turns back off, which is important. And it will have an effect on how effective your compressor is. I generally speaking, again, for human voices, I generally speaking keep those pretty low. Like a pretty quick attack and a fairly quick decay. So I'm talking like less than a second attack, maybe a 1 to 2 second delay. And you can play around with that. And again, it kind of depends mostly that I've noticed, it depends on the surrounding noise. If there's a lot of noise in the area, if there's a lot of noise, you're in trouble, basically. That's kind of the flat-out answer, but also, if you leave your attack and decay too long on something with a lot of noise, you tend to sort of hear the noise coming in and out as the compressor is coming in and on and off, and it starts to sound like you've used a compressor, and that's never good. So that's how dynamic compression works. I use it on every show, but really at like a pretty reasonable levels. I mean, the noise floor is very low. It's just basically to bring up my levels without bringing up the noise. I mean, that's one thing that it does really well. So that's kind of what I use it for. But people use it just as much in music, drum tracks, everything like that. It's a very, very common effect. So play around with it, get to know it, and you might start to like it a lot because it really does help you strengthen the signal. I think it's time for a cup of coffee. How about you?
I'm a coffee cup. I'm hot, so handle me with care.
So I learned a couple of new tricks the other day, I don't really remember how, but one of them was a KDE trick that I figured I'd go ahead and cover. I don't know if you're a big K-Runner user. I love it. It's one of the things that it's one of my main interfaces, to be honest. And if you bring up K-Runner, okay, K-Runner, for those of you who, for whatever reason, are not using KDE, is a pop-up run command interface, I guess, is what you people call it. I don't know what to call it. I've never known what to call it. But it's like this thing that pops up and you can type into it and it does things. Typically, I use it as an application launcher. That's kind of how I use it. I just super spacebar and type in the name of the application I want. It brings up the most logical result from my desktop files and, you know, my application.desktop files, and I hit return and it launches the application. That's how I launch most of my applications, except for the ones that I use all the time, which I have assigned to just a super, you know, super F, super K, super X, super T shortcut commands. Except Emacs, and Emacs never made it into my super sequence for some reason, not really sure why. It's really odd. I just now realize that I always use KRunner to launch Emacs. Anyway, it exists. It's very cool. It's been around for a while. I mean, ever since, I think it's been with KDE 4 ever since 4.0. But it has quickly gained a lot of little plugins to it so that you can hit super space and get, or whatever you use. I think Alt F2 is the default command, but that's ridiculous. Who uses the F keys? So I do super space. And there's applications. You can also search your bookmarks and your web history, which is annoying. You can do calculations. That's really cool. I knew about that already. But if you don't, you can. You can do like a, if you hit equals and then some mathematical equation, it'll give you the result of that equation. It's very nice. And you can control media players and find devices and shut down all kinds of things. Well, the other day, I don't remember what I was doing, but I noticed that there was a spell checker module in KRunner. So I turned it on and gave it a go, and you hit whatever combination you want to use for KRunner. I use super space bar, and then type in the word spell, S-P-E-L-L, and then the word that you want it to check for you. So let's do, I don't know, hypocrisy. So if you spell hypocrisy like it sort of sounds, H-I-P-O-C-R-A-C-Y, obviously it's going to tell you that it's incorrectly spelled. But it doesn't just tell you, oh, it's incorrect. It gives you suggestions. And there it is, right? That's the first result. H-Y-P-O-C-R-I-S-Y. So it's really handy. It's really handy for me because there's this great little XFCE dictionary that I use all the time. I think it's called Dictionary, or Dictionary Client. And it's from the XFCE side of things, and so it ships with Slackware. So it's kind of default dictionary that I use on the desktop, but I don't know, this is really nice, just being able to hit something and get a spell check. I do a lot of writing for one reason or another, so having lots of access to spell checking is very, very helpful for me. So I was really excited to find that one. That one is a really cool feature. So if you're using KDE and you are using KRunner at all, try it. It's really neat. Spell something, and it will tell you whether you are correct or not correct. Another cool thing that I learned was a grep trick. So I grep a lot, I'm sure most of us do, and one of the things that I was really, I was doing some greps through a Git log. Not that that even matters, I just wanted to sound like I really knew a lot, so I wanted to say the phrase Git log, or grepping through a Git log, even better. But I actually was. I was doing a Git log of the Slack builds stuff, because I wanted to see if there were any Slack builds that I maintained that I'd forgotten to update or verify or anything like that. So I was doing that, and I wanted to grep for my name in the commits, but at the same time, if I literally just grep for my name, then all I get are the lines with my name in them, and I don't know what that's associated with. I know that I committed, like, these many times, but which package is it talking about? So I needed context. Turns out that if you do something like, you know, whatever you're doing, like git log, and then pipe grep dash capital A 3, let's say, and dash capital B 3, let's say, then you're grepping for... Oh, I forgot to tell it what I was grepping for. That's funny. Space, not Klaatu. Okay, now I'm grepping for not Klaatu in the git log, but the dash A3 will give me three lines after the grep result, and the dash B gives me three lines before the grep result. So you get, like, these chunks of grep results. It's fantastic. If you grep and you've always wanted there to be some context for what you're grepping, that's the answer right there. It's built into grep all along, dash A for your after, and dash B for your before, some number of lines for each, and you get context. Pretty cool, huh? A little while ago now, the 6th, I think it was, a Humble Indie Bundle was released. Where it was posted, I guess. And Humble Indie Bundle, of course, I'm sure you probably all know, but just in case, it's a collection of indie games, video games, that are sort of bundled together, hence the name, and sold at a price of whatever you want to pay. So I've habitually gotten these Humble Indie Bundles in the past. I think, actually, I was looking back at what I've got, I think I've only missed, like, one of them. Because, well, technically two, but, because I missed the first one, but the second or third, I think, actually offered everything in the first again. So, it was, I ended up catching up, and then I think I missed one batch in there that just didn't really look at all interesting to me. But anyway, so I've gotten them every single time so far. I've played literally maybe a grand total of 15 to 20 minutes total gameplay. I don't know that that's very good. But that's not to say that the games aren't any good. It's literally just that I don't have the patience or interest in actually playing games. I have mentioned, I think, on this show a couple of times before that I'm really kind of interested, almost morbidly so. I mean, like, it's in spite of my disinterest in games, I seem to be very interested in the art of games and the culture of video games. All my friends love video games. I've seen video games. I think they look really cool. They're some of them are just beautifully done. You know, it's kind of neat. I imagine. I also like the interactive storytelling aspect of it. I just haven't really gotten into games themselves myself. But that hasn't stopped me from purchasing the Humble Indie Bundles. I sort of sat back and wondered to myself why I did this, why I purchased these Humble Bundles. And I know that one really sort of obvious, almost... knee-jerk reaction is that it's because I want to support... I'm in the position where I can pay and support not just Linux, and that's what you thought I was going to say, but also independent game developers, because I think that's neat. You know, I think it's cool that people are sitting down making video games. It's kind of like, you know, independent film and stuff like that. It's a venture, and it's admirable, and people who take risks and put themselves into something so thoroughly, they deserve to be paid. You know, that's just how the world works. You do something that requires you to work that hard on something, you ought to get paid for it. And I know that's not very capitalistic, you know, it's supposed to be supply and demand, and if your product isn't in demand, then you should not be rewarded for your effort. But darn it, I think they should be rewarded for their effort. That's one reason I pay for them. The other reason I think is because, of course, you know, Humble Bundle does this little pie chart, and they show how much each user of a specific OS has paid, and pretty consistently Linux comes out on top in terms of like price voluntarily, the volunteer price for this bundle, because you can pay whatever you want under some limitation. I think it's $1, but and they have a suggested donation, and then you can pay even more than that. So you do that and you kind of get a statistic thing going for your operating system, and Linux typically scores either very high, I think, or the highest. So that's kind of neat and fun and competitive. So that's another reason that I do it. And I think another reason that I do it, well, one other reason is because I really do in my heart intend to play these games. I really do. Every time I'm purchasing it, I'm like, this time I'm going to really play these games too. And it never happens. But the other reason I think I might do it is because there's a part of me, I think, and probably a part of many of us, that wants Linux to be at least just recognized enough so that life is more convenient for us. And by this I mean, how many times have you gone out to a computer store, or even if you've gone just online, and if it's online and this is happening, then you've probably gone to a computer store afterwards, but you go out and you look for something. It could be anything. It could be a scanner, it could be a printer, it could be a laptop, could be a digital camera, and you go out and you're looking for this thing, and you've heard great things about this model, or your friend has this model, and so you're going to go buy one, and then it hits you. You're like, oh, wait a minute, what if there's some thing about this product that doesn't work with Linux? And then if I buy it, and if I open it, and if I break all the little plastic tape seals, I won't be able to take it back for a trade-in or a refund. They'll charge me restocking fee, or they just won't take it back at all. And so you start to get pretty nervous. So I think that a lot of Linux users want Linux to be just popular enough, at least. I mean, world domination's one thing, but how about scaling that back and just saying, let's just be just popular enough so that when we go to a site and look at a product, we see something that says, yes, it works with Linux, or even, no, this does not work with Linux. Some kind of answer, one way or the other. Something more than an email to the salesperson, or a live chat to a salesperson saying, does it work on Linux, and them saying, what's Linux? Or you go out to the store, and they say, what's Linux? And then you say, well, could I put my hands on this product and try it with my laptop? I have it right here. And they're like, no, you can't do that. So I think that there's this almost, it's more than convenience. It's almost just kind of like, this is the world we live in, with products that if we purchase them and they don't work, we run the risk of not getting a refund of our money, because that's just how, for some reason, technology purchases work that way, from what I've seen. And so you're literally hindered from purchasing something that you want because you're not really sure that it's going to work with Linux. and you just want to be sure that it will or won't. You want an answer one way or the other, and so you believe that by supporting things that market to Linux, then eventually this sort of recognition will occur. Now, if that is something that is on your mind, then I can say that I believe that is true. I believe that is a correct assumption, because I myself had been a user of an operating system that was very, very, and still is to some degree, much less degree now, but it was at one point this old OS that I used to use, it was considered a niche OS, and when you went out to most computer stores or went online to purchase something, you really didn't have an assurance that there were drivers or that it was going to be compatible with this operating system that I used to use that I won't mention by name. And in recent years, I mean, I can remember as a kid, it was just all bets were off. If you wanted something, you had to get the version that was made for this particular brand of computer. And that's it. I mean, that was your choice. That one or two different products, that was what you could buy if you had this particular brand of computer that ran this particular brand of operating system. But now, it's not like that at all. There's some recognition in stores and online where it will actually say, yes, this is this and this compatible. And that's great for the users of those computers that get that recognition. And you think, why can't we have that? So I think that supporting things that market to Linux, I think that's a realistic expectation, that if you do that enough for a long enough period of time, vendors will start to say, okay, well, we'll start marketing towards this operating system as well. And that's a good thing. That was kind of the very technical and slightly, I guess, political view of Humble Indie Bundle. And I don't mean it to come across so calculated and kind of scientific, because at the end of the day, you're just paying some money for some games that you can play on the operating system that you run. And there's a lot, that's a very liberating feeling, actually. And that's actually what Torchlight, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about right now, according to my little notes, that's what Torchlight made me realize, because I downloaded this little installer, and like I said, I've done this four or five other times with the other Humble Indie Bundles, but for Torchlight in particular, this one looked to me, and keep in mind that I'm not an expert at video games, so I'm consider me a noob, and I mean, I'm the kind of person with video games that a lot of people are with movies, and they just annoy me to no end. You know, if you show them like this great groundbreaking independent film that's just so cool and weird and progressive and nonlinear and it's shot differently and it's in black and white and all these, and it's got bad sound and it's out of focus half the time, you know, all these ugly things, and you're so excited about it, and they're like, well, it didn't really seem like a real movie, and then they go see the latest action film or whatever from Hollywood, and they're like, ah, now that's a real movie. So that's me for video games, right? I don't understand the charm of 8-bit video games. I don't understand games. You have to show me a game with lots of lighting effects and lots of blood and gore, and when I see a video game, these are things that I identify with. Oh, that's a high-quality video game. So I'm speaking absolutely as like this sort of very non-independently thinking kind of traditionalist view of video games, and for the real video game connoisseurs out there, I do apologize. That being said, Torchlight to me, when I downloaded it and I looked at the screenshots and stuff, I looked at the thing and I thought, wow, this is different than the other Humble Indie Bundle offerings that I've seen. I mean, World of Goo was cool, but it was highly stylized, right? It had like little tar ball gooey things flying around, or not flying around, they were sort of, you build structures with them, and it was very high contrast, and it wasn't like a, you know, you didn't have a character that you were moving around the screen, and they weren't swinging a sword and shooting guns and things. It was goo balls. And Osmos, I think, is another one that I played, and that was like literally you're a cell under a microscope, and you're like with Osmosis you are growing your cell or something like that. So it's completely not like when I think of a video game, that's not what I'm thinking of, right? Like where's Lara Croft? Where's the person running around, jumping from ledge to ledge, shooting pistols and stuff like that? I didn't see any of those things as video games. But Torchlight, I saw Torchlight, and it looked like a real video game. You know, it was like this sort of weird sort of top view, sort of three-quarter top view, which was kind of weird. I've not really seen any games necessarily from that angle, but that's how they did it, and it's sort of a dungeon crawler, and it's an RPG game, because you pick up weapons and skills and stuff like that, and you can put them into your inventory, so that's familiar to me. So it was a little bit dungeony and dragony, but it was also very much like a first-person shooter without being a first-person shooter. I don't know if there's such a thing as a third-person shooter, but it's kind of like that. So when I saw it, I thought that it looked like a quote-unquote real video game. And I think I must have seen enough screenshots or maybe some gameplay footage. I don't really remember how I saw, but there were lots of effects. Like, people would cast spells, and it wasn't just like a flash. It was like these streams of light and smoke and things like that, you know? Like, really, really lush and vibrant colors and particles and stuff like that. So I was really, really amazed by this, because to me that didn't go along with independent gaming. You know, that wasn't something that I was used to. I thought, well, what I'm going to do is install Torchlight on my big workstation. I mean, like, my serious workstation, the one that I use at work, for video editing, and for music stuff, because it's a really powerful box. You know, my work paid me to build it. It's got everything you could ever want in it. It's a really nice box. And I was sitting there looking at this thing, and I'm proud of how I've used it so far for Blender and Kdenlive and Qtractor and GIMP and Inkscape and Scribus. You know, I've not underutilized my resource at all. But in the hands of someone else, this could be a very powerful gaming rig, I realized. And I thought, well, playing World of Goo or Osmos on here is not going to really be the gaming that this thing deserves. So I'm going to try Torchlight on here, and I'll turn on all the effects and make sure all the textures are on high and all this other stuff. So I installed Torchlight, and it's got this really slick installer, which I've actually seen along with games from other humble bundles, called Nix Installer or Nix Staller. Has nothing to do with Nix packaging thing, which GubNew did an HPR episode on fairly recently about this Nix packaging thing and this Nix OS that uses the Nix packaging. So this has nothing to do with that. This is just something that some guy made called Nix Installer, meaning, you know, the traditional sense of Nix, like something that is Unix-like. So Nix Installer, and it's a nice little GUI installer that will install the game to wherever you tell it to install it. So I just put it into /local/games, but you could put it just as easily in /games, and it will try to register if you're doing it on like Fedora or Debian. It would try to register, and presumably Arch, I'm not sure, it will try to register with your package manager that package has been installed. So that's kind of cool. But it's a really nice little installer program. It's GUI. It looks like a traditional kind of installation thing. I'm going to look at it further just because I think, I mean, for a lot of people, like it or not, installing even via a shell script is foreign and it's different. So Nixstaller makes it feel very normal, because you get to click on the yes, install this thing, and you get to put in your password, your little root password. So it was very slick. I was really impressed with the way that these games install themselves, and I'm impressed with the game itself. So Torchlight is, like I say, sort of a third-person, if that is a genre, third-person RPG shooter, sort of, because you go through and you, I mean, it's an RPG, so you're going through, you're exploring places and you're encountering monsters and you are killing them with whatever skill set you happen to have invested in for your character. Very kind of traditional sort of feeling RPG gameplay. It's set in a kind of medieval / steampunk / western sort of setting. It's really cool. There's a lot of mines, and one character is, you know, is casting spells and stuff, but one of the other characters that you could play seems to have, like, something that looks like guns or pistols, so you kind of get that it's sort of a very alternate kind of history thing going on. And it's really cool. It's a lot of fun. I mean, again, I honestly have only played it for about 10-15 minutes, and then I got bored. But again, that's not because of the game. That's every game for me. And I also had a lot of trouble with the... because you have to, you know, it's on the computer, so you have to use the mouse and the keyboard, and I'm not used to that at all. All of my experience gaming has been on console gaming of some sort, so I'm absolutely not used to having to use a mouse to click on places that you want to go. That's really complex. Don't like it at all. So I was trying to kind of get used to that, but I wasn't really doing very well. And it is funny, because I will spend hours trying to learn a new application if it has anything to do with programming or video editing or motion graphics or music. I mean, heck, even some, like, not Office, but, like, page layout, obviously, illustration, all those things, animation, that stuff I will spend as much time as I need to get really good at that application. Games, you tell me that I have to click a mouse and I have to get used to how the character moves, and suddenly I'm completely lost and frustrated. Very strange condition. I don't know. I'm working on it. Point is, though, that Torchlight, if you have not played it, it's a really good little game. It's really cool. It looks like a, quote, real, unquote, game to a complete gaming noob who has no idea what video games artistically have going for them, other than, ooh, that looks pretty and shiny, and I like it how that head explodes when I shoot it. You know, that's the extent of my appreciation for gaming, I'm sad to say. But Torchlight was very, very cool. I highly recommend that you check it out if you have not checked it out. And furthermore, it installs on Linux. It plays on your Linux computer. So if you're one of those people who's not really had that experience, then you almost owe it to yourself to try that out. And I mean, Torchlight, the Humble Bundle is over, so you can't go get it now, I guess, but I'm sure it's available somewhere online for Linux. I mean, for purchase and stuff. Either way, like, just next time a Humble Bundle comes around, if you haven't played any game on Linux, like a serious game with graphics and stuff, and you've got a computer that can, you owe it to yourself, because it's really kind of an interesting experience, I have to say. It's, you go through it, and it works on Linux, and it installs, and it looks good. It's just, it gives you a sense of, I don't know, of weird sort of validation and authenticity, you know, hey, this is my OS, and I'm playing this game on it, and it works, and it looks great. It's a weirdly satisfying thing. So check it out, and if you missed it, then check out a different Humble Bundle, because they're entertaining. That's about it for this episode, I think. This has been GNU World Order. My name's Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info. You can IRC me on IRC. On Freenode Network, in the channel Oddcast Planet, and a few others. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You might also find me on Jabber sometimes. I don't get on there very often lately, but I'm notklaatu@jabber.org. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
She ended up paying for the chocolate malt.